authorization for multiple aircraft and airlines.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this workshop. From the sort of area that I've been interested in terms of the area of swarming and research on multiple vehicles, has been from a design perspective, which is you have a group of vehicles and you have a particular task or goal that you'd like that group to achieve. And I've been interested in trying to understand how one would take that task and distribute it amongst the vehicles or amongst the entities that we're looking at, in such a way that if each group of vehicles or each vehicle performs a local optimization that we define, that the overall an overall global optimization problem is solved that's connected to the particular problem that we're interested in solving. This is a project, so I'm going to be talking about a project that's it's fairly new. It's we've been working on this for about a year now. The motivation came from two sources. So we have a project with Stan Osher, with the Navy, interested in computational methods for collaborative motion. So how does one design algorithms for multiple unmanned air vehicles that are coordinating and communicating with each other to perform certain tasks like surveillance of a particular region? And at the same time, we've been working with NASA, the air traffic group at NASA, in trying to build models for air traffic flow and use these models to design new controller policies. So policies that are either implemented by air traffic controllers or are automated so that the algorithms run on board the flight management systems of the aircraft to automatically do some of the tasks that air traffic controllers do now, which are like scheduling and routing tasks. In particular, scheduling and rerouting when there are disturbances in the airspace, such as bad weather. So we're building on previous work, and in this particular project, we've been interested in, especially from the air traffic control side, in trying to use models that we've developed previously to design new policies. And these policies, there's particular interest from many different agencies to design distributed policies, so to allow the aircraft and the airlines, the sort of stakeholders in this system, to have a say, to enunciate their preferences in routing and scheduling, and have those preferences incorporated in the overall policies. So this is joint work with one of my previous students, Alex Byand. He's now a professor at Berkeley. Two of my current students, Robin Raffard and Stephen Mosslander, who are PhD students at Stanford. So I have a joint appointment this year between Berkeley and Stanford. And also with Stephen Boyd at Stanford, who worked on the optimization algorithms with Stephen. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about two flavors of this problem. And I'm going to use the multiple vehicle problem to as more of a motivation for presenting our method for doing distributed optimization. So in this problem, we have a group of vehicles. And these vehicles have local objectives. They usually have some kind of trajectory that they're interested in following. They're interested in being safe, so they'd like to maintain some measure of safety. That's usually modeled as some kind of, well, first of all, safety with respect to their own dynamics, but also in terms of interaction with other vehicles, so something that we call global objectives, maintaining a certain separation with other vehicles, so not running into each other. In terms of the problem when we apply it to airlines, we still have the local objectives. Each aircraft in the airline has to satisfy the constraints inherent in the dynamics and the actuator inputs. But with the airlines, we're interested in problems, global objectives, which have more to do with maximum throughput. And the coupling constraints, we're interested in collision avoidance, of course, but the coupling constraints come more from constraints that are imposed on the network, like maximum density over links. And these aircraft are sharing these links in the airspace, and so they have to coordinate with each other to maintain the maximum density constraints. For the multiple vehicle problem, we're also interested, as I said, for the Navy in problems of region coverage or surveillance. So the vehicles need to somehow coordinate with each other to maintain perhaps a uniform coverage over a region. And then the constraints are really what make the problem interesting. So usually in problems like this, we don't have, well, okay, in some cases we have a central computer in which a lot of the computation can be performed. But sometimes we don't, and therefore we have constraints in that we've got a number of distributed vehicles, and the processors are therefore distributed. Where you want to do the computation is distributed throughout the airspace. In the air traffic control problem, even though we do have access to a central computer, the optimization problem is so large that it's impossible to do a central optimization problem in real time. So there's sort of physical reasons why we would want to distribute the optimization or distribute the computation around each vehicle or groups of vehicles. And in particular, this is interesting for sort of military, non-cooperative scenarios, but it's also very interesting for the airline problem, in which vehicles have a lot of, or airlines have a lot of information about, you know, their operating costs that they don't necessarily want to share with everybody else in the network for business reasons. So there's a need to incorporate private information. The sort of not all information should be shared amongst all entities in the system. Okay, so in terms of collision avoidance, we've done quite a bit of work in sort of some sub-problems of this, but the overall problem is for us is still wide open. This is just to show you some of the work that we've done in the past. This was done in the past 5 years in my lab at Stanford. We have two unmanned air vehicles, fixed wing, 10-foot wingspan unmanned air vehicles that we fly at NASA Ames. And of course, you can't really see them. They're just blobs in this video that we've taken from the ground. But this was an experiment in which we were testing out collision avoidance schemes that we designed using reachable set methodology. And the idea here is if you look at a group of aircraft and you want to guarantee that all aircraft stay a certain distance apart from each other, one can decompose this problem into groups of pairs of aircraft and then compute what we call blunder zones, or regions, and they're relative to each aircraft, so around one aircraft relative to another aircraft, so this one, for example, or that one, for example, here, describing the set of states for which, for all possible actions of one of the aircraft, the other aircraft, if you were inside that region, they could come closer than the certain required distance. We posed and solved this problem as an optimization differential game if we consider disturbances in the system. And we showed that these regions, they're actually level sets, and I'm showing sort of the whole set in 3D here, for which slices represent the slices here. These sets are level sets of a certain Hamilton-Jacobi equation, and we've developed methods based on level set methods. So this was with my PhD student, Ian Mitchell, who's now at UBC, and joint with, this was part of our MURI with Stan, and one of Stan's amazing students, Ron Fedko, who's at Stanford. We use level set methods to design, to basically compute in a very efficient way these reachable sets. So we can compute them online and update them as we're flying. So these are our two aircraft flying along. We're flying parallel approaches. One aircraft starts to blunder, and as soon as the other aircraft touches that reachable, the boundary of the reachable set around the first aircraft, that second aircraft, which we call the evader in this sort of pursuit evasion scenario, has to perform a particular emergency escape maneuver, which is computed as part of that reachable set calculation.
What's the blue, the blue line?
Yeah, so what happens is, what we're plotting here is, this is the part of that blunder zone corresponding here, I've shown it in red, here it's in blue.
Yeah.
But as long as this aircraft is not touching that boundary, they're fine. As soon as this aircraft moves in such a way that that second aircraft touches the boundary, then it means that if that vehicle doesn't do anything, they could come closer than the requisite separation distance. And so it indicates, and also the reason it's nice to solve it as an optimizer, an optimal control problem, is that this blunder zone not only gives you the set of safe, the partition between the safe and unsafe configurations, it also gives you the best control input that this aircraft should apply given the worst possible uncertainty of that aircraft. So we've done, and this algorithm works well in low dimensions. So it's based on level set methods. So we can do the computation in three, for, we've done some five-dimensional in the continuous state computations, but we're really restricted to look at, for example, pairs of aircraft where the dimensionality of those two models can be sort of kept low, less than three or four dimensions.
What are the five dimensions projecting physically?
Okay, so in this problem we actually only have three dimensions, and the three dimensions are because we're solving this algorithm in the horizontal plane, and we're considering kinematic approximation models of the aircraft, x, y, so the two x, y coordinates, as well as the relative heading. And those are the three coordinates that we're considering in this problem. It's three dimensions, we can do it in real time. We've solved other problems, which are more, so we've done an envelope protection problem for an autolander, and that was in five dimensions, where we're looking at the velocity, so XY position, velocity, flight path angle, angle of attack, so other more state variables. Here we don't consider altitude because we're assuming that everything's happening at in the plane. And the reason, so this is meant to be a scenario which is approximating a closely spaced parallel approach into airports. And even though you are changing your altitude, you can consider everything to be projected onto a plane in this practical problem because you don't want aircraft going above and below the other aircraft. You'd like to keep them, as they're coming into land, you'd like to keep them separated by a certain horizontal distance. It's such a controlled scenario that there's no way you would allow aircraft going above and below each other.
Aircraft are generally crashing. Don't you want to abort the landing?
Right, so you'd want to abort it so that one... so that they have their missed approaches which don't cause them to go on top of each other. You know, the controllers look at a plan view display, so they look at a two-dimensional display of the aircraft data. So even if they're away from airports, so if you're looking at en route airspace, controllers don't like it when two aircraft go, you know, in the same region of altitude. They don't like it when two aircraft go one on top of the other, separated by altitude, because the blocks, you know, the data blocks of the aircraft get...
But for escape, that would seem like an option.
Well, it is in a militaristic scenario, but not in air traffic control. They would never have one aircraft go on top of the other, just because the range of altitudes when you're coming into land is not very high. In general, in en route airspace, you do use altitude for separation, but there you usually have aircraft that are flying in the general direction of east to west, fly at odd thousand altitudes, and west to east at even thousand altitudes. So they really do use altitude for separation, but not really for tactical maneuvers like this. Okay, so that was some previous work that we did. And so now moving on to a more difficult problem. This is sort of a motivation for the multiple vehicle problem that we're considering in this Navy research, is the problem of region surveillance. Now this is a snapshot from the research of Professor Robin Murphy. She's a professor at the University of South Florida, and she runs the robotic search and rescue program at the University of South Florida. And she and her vehicles were at the Katrina search, at the Katrina Hurricane Katrina site, and she was doing surveillance of, you know, hard to reach areas with coupled fixed wing aircraft, unmanned aircraft, which was actually in this experiment was being remotely piloted from the ground. The fixed wing aircraft was flying at higher altitudes, getting this bird's eye type view of destroyed areas. And then she had a rotorcraft unmanned air vehicle, again being piloted from the ground remotely, which was able to take information from that high-flying vehicle and go up and look in windows of buildings and things, so into hard-to-reach areas, see whether or not there are people who need to be rescued. So this is great motivation for the kinds of surveillance problems where you may have heterogeneous vehicles, complex, optimization problems that you're interested in solving, and you don't necessarily have good communication with the ground. So ideally, rather than think about a number of vehicles which are all, each of which are remotely piloted from the ground and the people controlling them have to sort of talk to each other and coordinate, it would be nice to think about a more automated approach where the vehicles themselves have the ability to figure out the best route that they should take, the best the number of the sequence of tasks that they should perform to get maximum surveillance over the region, which includes not only like wide area surveillance, but also looking into the details of what's going on. So that's one of the motivations. We don't know how to solve this problem yet. And then another motivation, this is the background work we've done in air traffic flow modeling. So I just wanted to show you this slide. Over the past few years, we've been developing models for modeling the flow of air traffic through the air traffic network. And we're considering models which could treat large numbers of aircraft. So over large regions of airspace, like this eastern corridor, for example, looking into the approaches into Chicago O'Hare. And the model that we've been using is what's called a Lighthill-Whittam-Richards, LWR, partial differential equation flow model, in which our state variables are the density of the aircraft, the number of aircraft, so the density of those aircraft over the particular links that we're modeling, so the jetways in the sky that we're modeling. So we have density, so X here represents the position along each link, density along the link, and then the flux, the flow of aircraft is the density times the velocity of the aircraft. So this PDE can be used to describe the flow of particles through a network. And
so these jetways, as you described, they seem to have no leakage from one to the other, by the way you've written the first equation. Is that definite?
No, they do have links. So the way we develop the model is that each link is numbered, and the outflow of this link becomes the initial condition of that link. So we explicitly represent each link, and they each have their number. And then the inflow conditions are defined by the outflow conditions of the previous link.
So the first equation is just reflecting the local conservation.
Yeah, so this is the flow along a particular link, and then the network model links these together. We have, so there's interesting sort of control parameters, which controllers use. So controllers use velocity, so velocity of aircraft flow. And this is sort of a nice model, because air traffic controllers tend to say, well, I need all aircraft on this link or these few links to decrease their velocity. So it's not usually, you know, even though they tell individual aircraft to decrease their velocity, the policies are usually in a region all aircraft should decrease their velocity to meet capacity constraints. So velocity on the link is one control parameter. This parameter beta, which represents the split. So you can see I had this initial standard route into Chicago. And then there's these what are called managed arrival reservoirs that controllers use. They sort of like these approach links on highways that increase the capacity, metering lanes on highways, which are used to increase the capacity of the highway. Controllers will open up, say, in times of very dense traffic, new routes, so new approaches into Chicago. The aircraft still have to land on the same runways. But it's thought that by making more use of the airspace, you can basically get more aircraft that are sequenced to land when a landing slot becomes open. So the parameters here represent how much flow, beta represents how much flow should be split from the regular direct route into this managed arrival reservoir. Holding patterns are also managed arrival reservoirs.
Typically, if I'm not mistaken, the LWR approaches comes from
from the ground,
right?
From
where it makes sense because you have high density. And is it the approximation?
So that's a very good question. Which the point is that the LWR, the Lighthill-Whittam-Richards equation, is usually models traffic flow, so highway flow on the ground. We took it and built a model for air traffic flow based on this, and so we had to. We have a lot of data from NASA Ames about air traffic flow through the network. So we spent a lot of time identifying the parameters. So from the data, what are typical velocity profiles over certain links? First of all, we identified that. But it's necessary when one's building a new model to make sure that model is a good model for the system. So what we did, and this was in building this model, we first identified the model based on weeks of traffic. So identified the parameters of the model. And then we initiated that model with initial data, so initial condition data of traffic through the network that we have from NASA. We ran our simulation model on that data. And then we also had the data of what actually happened. So we could compare and validate what our model said against what actually happened. And we tuned the parameters so that we got a very good correlation for the days that we tried against the model and the actual data.
So the fact that, sorry, the fact that if that presumably you have traffic works with really low density, is not an issue.
It's not an issue. So this model works even when the densities are low. And the validation, so we ran the model in terms of the density, and then so we ended up with solutions in terms of density. We integrated those to get aircraft count, and then we compared those aircraft counts, so aircraft count per link, with the actual data. And it was remarkably close. So this is, and actually this has been kind of a really cool project in itself, in building a model which is has great properties of computational complexity, meaning it's got, in order to solve this model, it's got very low complexity compared to traditional air traffic flow models, which are Lagrangian, which basically take into account the motion of each aircraft. So you have to enumerate, the complexity of the model increases as the number of aircraft increase. Here, the complexity of the model is based on the number of links, because we're lumping aircraft together into this density variable, and then we're integrating it out afterwards. But the important thing is that each PDE that we have to solve is very low dimensional. So Xi, we're doing this in two dimensions again, but Xi are one dimensional links. So X represents the position along each link. So when we have to do the hard stuff, which is solving this PDE, we're just solving large sets of one dimensional PDEs, which can be done very, very quickly. So that's why we did this.
How many airplanes do you assume per link?
Well, it depends on the size of the link, which we set. So even though we have like one link here, we can break that up into smaller pieces. So in this, we're typically considering in a model like this, which is coming from sort of the East Coast, well, I'm not showing all of it, but we have coming from the New York airports into Chicago, a couple of thousand aircraft over the course of a few hours, like 200 minutes is the kinds of simulations we were running.
The boundary conditions at airports are presumably fixed. What about the boundary conditions at the many
infill points? So that's one of the control variables. So the three control variables are velocity, flow split parameter, and the inflow. And so inflow represents the inflow of aircraft into the system, and they're coming in at we're assuming that the aircraft are entering the network through airports, so they're coming from origin airports. This is a very interesting control parameter because it reflects changing this control parameter reflects something that the FAA does all the time, which is this ground hold program. So often you're held in Boston, you're flying to San Francisco, you're held in Boston because there's weather over Chicago. And you're held because there's weather now over Chicago. You don't know what the system will be like in sort of 2 hours when you actually get to Chicago. So the FAA has something which they call a ground hold program, or ground delay program, which is really sort of based on heuristics, how it's worked in the past. And so our idea was if we could model that as a control variable, then when we start using this model for designing control policies, we could perhaps study the ground delay program and propose maybe more accurate ways to do such a thing. So how would we restrict inflow, or how would we temper the inflow over a time horizon?
I presume velocity is some crazy function of density or something. Otherwise, it's a linear equation. Or are they?
So the velocity, it seems to me, and this is a question for me too, maybe, this Eulerian fail is something that your air traffic controllers decide and sort of suggest to the aircraft to obey, as opposed to something that is dependent on density in an automated sort of feedback way.
Okay, so I think there's two points. Whether we're building a model to validate, whether we're trying to match existing data, or then when we're trying to use that for control.
Yeah.
So in the model that we built, velocity is a function of the link and the spatial point along the link, although we usually make these constant per link and time. We don't make it a complicated function of the density. Now, when we're using it in control, the controller is presumably looking at the density, and if it's high, he's trying to decrease the velocity of aircraft coming into that link. So that's the goal of this, is to use this model in feedback to prescribe velocity, flow split parameter, and inflow in order to satisfy the constraints of maximum density. So yes, it could be a complicated function of the...
In principle, it could be shocked, God forbid, in the one.
It could be, yeah. We're using, to solve this, we use the... So we use this in feedback using the Jameson-Schmidt-Turkel scheme to solve the one-dimensional PDEs. So we basically have a computational program that's running in feedback, so we don't solve this analytically. Okay, what we would like to do, so that's sort of what we've done. Now going to control is what I just said. We'd like to be able to, so airlines have a lot of stake in the system. And there's a movement in the FAA and NASA and in a lot of people that are consulting for them and a lot of the airlines to allow the airlines to enunciate their preferences in terms of what route they prefer to take, what how you know they'd like to restrict their inflow in order to meet the density constraints. So it's particularly important. It's not so important if everything's running smoothly, but if there's a weather pattern that happens and everything's severely restricted, the idea is to let the airlines say how they would like to either restrict their flow or new routes they'd like to take. And so there's an economist at Stanford, Paul Milgram, we've been working with. He consults with the airlines, and he's one of the people that did some of the design of auctions for the FCC. So his point of view is we should consider this as a large optimization problem and solve it in a method of using, so do sort of mechanism design for this network using auctions. So that's been some motivation for what we've done. Okay, so that's a kind of a long introduction to the two main pieces of the talk, which are, first of all, to describe the idea of taking a large optimization problem and decomposing it into a smaller number of optimization problems that can either be run on board each vehicle or at each airline, and then applying that to the air traffic flow problem. So in this first part of the talk, which I'll go quite quickly through, I guess, this is I'm going to use a sort of simpler example, which is a small number of vehicles that have to fly in formation. So it's similar to some of the problems that have been solved in the swarming community. And that's to describe the decentralized optimization algorithm, and then I'll show how we applied that to the air traffic flow problem.
There's a similar problem in the internet where they take the utilities of all the users and do exactly certain utility computations.
Right.
Right.
So
are you proposing something similar?
Well, we've been motivated by that. So Scott Schenker is somebody who's worked on that problem in the internet. And so motivated by it, and we'd like to move towards some of these similar solutions, but taking into account the more severe restrictions that you have for air traffic flow. Okay, so the first problem, decentralized optimization based on dual decomposition. And this is work with my student Robin Raffard and Stephen Boyd at Stanford. Okay, so let's start with a simple problem. We have five vehicles, and each vehicle has its own dynamics. So we describe those in terms of generally nonlinear dynamics, in terms of the state and the inputs. And let's assume there's n aircraft. And then the aircraft have their local objectives. We call that the local cost function. And that can encode things like the desired trajectory for each aircraft. So maybe there's some enunciated desired trajectory that each aircraft should follow. We'd like to minimize the input energy as in a typical control problem. But there's also a global control function, which is, in this case, that the aircraft should maintain a particular formation with respect to each other. So it's a simple problem. We assume that the formation is given, and we assume that the original cost functions are given, so the original desired trajectory of each aircraft is given. And we'd like to figure out the optimal way for the aircraft to satisfy or to optimize both their local cost function as well as the global cost function. And often these could be in conflict with each other. Namely, if all aircraft are trying to follow the same target, then they're sort of trying to push the aircraft together while the formation constraint is trying to pull them apart into a formation. Some of the notation here, the formation constraint in this example are encoded by these relative position, delta yij. So we'd like the actual relative position of this aircraft with respect to these two to satisfy the formation constraint. We use this for each aircraft I in the formation, we use ri to represent the aircraft in that aircraft's neighborhood, so the aircraft with which it shares constraints. So here that's this aircraft and that aircraft. We could take those two, those local cost functions, sum them together and add it to the global cost function to form an aggregate cost function. And we could solve that as a large optimization problem. So here's the objectives, subject to the constraints, which are the dynamics of the individual aircraft. And I just showed a movie of that here, where I have the red aircraft represented the target aircraft that all the aircraft wanted to follow, yet they still had to maintain a particular formation, as I showed on the previous slide.
How are you specifying the formation? I mean, in your previous slide, it looks like each aircraft is sort of looking at one aircraft ahead of it.
Right.
Is that the way it works?
Well, the aircraft, so this aircraft, it's either following or it's equivalent to the target aircraft. And then the aircraft, I mean, I'm modeling this as, so this aircraft has to maintain a certain delta y ij with respect to that aircraft and that aircraft. So
well,
I just.
Well, so it's looking at
yeah, it's looking
other
at both.
Aircraft.
Now, this might not be the best way to do it. I've just assumed here that those are given to you. So I'm not solving the hard problem here of how does one come up with the way to, in this problem, I'm not asking how does one come up with the way you encode each of these cost functions. I assume that these cost functions are given to you and you want to find an intelligent way to maneuver, given that you have to try to satisfy both. So we could solve this as a centralized optimization problem. Here it's a small problem, and we can do that fairly easily. But in general, as I said, we don't necessarily have a central computer in situations like this. And also, in general, the problems are too large to be able to, even if we did have a central computer, to be able to solve them using a central computer. So that's motivation for why we would like to try to distribute this amongst the individual aircraft in the formation. We use a method called dual decomposition, which has been around for a long time. I guess one of the first references is the Danzig and Wolf paper in 1960, which introduced dual decomposition. We've been using Bert Sakas's nonlinear programming book as a reference for dual decomposition. The idea is that one primal problem, like the optimization problem that I showed in the previous view graph, it leads to possibly many dual problems. The dual decomposition method solves one instance of these many dual problems. It breaks the primal problem into a set of smaller problems, and in solving the dual, one gets a lower bound on the global optimal solution and also a feasible solution. So, and often it's easier to solve a dual problem than a primal problem. So we're doing two things. We're trying to break the primal problem into a number of smaller problems and then solve the dual of that kind of decentralized decentralized primal problem.
Can you just ask, are it also given to you the relative weight of global cost versus?
We assume that that's given. So that we assume that aircraft are allowed to provide some weight. So they have their own local cost, and they have some weight associated to that. And that gets captured in the aggregate cost function. So if I, I'll show this more with the airlines, but if one airline has a much more expensive operating procedure than another, then they'll have a local cost function which is weighted higher than the other local cost function. Mm-hmm. But we assume right now that that's given to us. And that's a good question. So we're, In solving this problem, we're assuming that these cost functions are given to us, and we're asking how would we solve this in a decentralized way. If the problem is convex, the dual decomposition method returns the global optimal solution. The problems are generally not convex that we're looking at. So if they're not convex, then one gets a duality gap, which represents the difference between the solution of the dual problem and the solution of the primal problem. And that's useful information because it not only gives you a lower bound on the solution, the duality gap, which you can estimate, tells you how far you are away from the actual global optimal solution. So there's many nice properties of dual problems. I can picture it here for that simple example. So I'm going to overview the kind of dual decomposition method pictorially with a simpler formation. I just have three aircraft, formation constraints between aircraft 1 and 2, delta 1, 2, and 2 and 3, delta 2, 3, are given. So the idea is the following. We have a particular primal problem that we want to solve, and it may be complex. Here it's easy, but it may be complex. And so the idea is to look at the variables in the system. So I have a variable associated to aircraft one, its state variables. And I would like to design a problem such that a variable, each variable only appears once in each term of my resulting objective function. So the variables which are related to aircraft one appear in the objective function twice. First, as in the enunciation of the local objective of aircraft one, trajectory following fuel minimization. But it also appears in the constraint with aircraft two. So there's a second place that it appears in the objective function. So what we do is we introduce slack variables. So we form a new primal problem in which we introduce as many slack variables as we have repeated instances of those variables in the objective function. So I keep one variable for the local, for including in the local cost of aircraft one. And then I introduce a new slack variable, I'll call it one tilde, which I'm going to use in the global, so the interconnection constraint part of the, so the global term in that objective function. Aircraft two has its local variables, it's got its constraint with aircraft one and its constraint with aircraft three. So I have three variables. I introduce two more slack variables. And these are all, these variables are set equal to each other in the decoupled primal problem. Similarly for aircraft three. And then in the formation of the dual problem, we dualize those constraints. So whenever we have a slack variable, we take that slack variable and we put it back into the cost function. So we take that equality constraint and we form a Lagrangian in which that there's a term in the new cost function, which are the Lagrangian variables multiplied by the variables 1 minus 1 prime. I'll show this on the next slide. But pictorially, the idea is to have the decoupled primal problem with the slack variables and formulate a dual problem in which we've got a number of smaller problems, so none of the variables in this problem are shared with the variables in this problem, or shared with the variables in this problem, etc. So we relax the constraint, and then we solve the dual problem to try to make these variables as close as possible to each other to achieve a feasible solution. So it's a standard dual formulation, and the only sort of art here, which is, I think, you know, is the choice of how many constraints to dualize, how to do that. The more constraints you dualize in general, the larger the duality gap. So to put that in equation, so I've got my original primal problem. Formulate a decoupled primal problem in which I introduce slack variables. So here's my slack variables. And then I dualize the problem. So I form, this is my Lagrangian, where I've introduced, so this constraint here appears through Lagrange multipliers mu. So you see this constraint here being brought into the objective function here, and this constraint here being brought into the objective function here. Okay, so then the dual function is the infimum of the Lagrangian, and the dual problem is to maximize the infimum of the Lagrangian, which is a fairly standard method. So what we see now is that what we have are, it's a larger objective function, but it's broken up into a number of terms, each of which only involves variables local to each problem. So the idea is that you can solve each problem, each vehicle or shared, like if you may have situations where you have variables shared between two aircraft, but you've got a number of small problems which can be solved locally. Okay, so the algorithm goes as follows. The communication between optimization problems happens through these Lagrange multipliers. And actually, there's two sets of Lagrange multipliers. I had the mu's and the lambdas on the previous graph. It turns out that the lambdas are a function of the mu's, or you can make it so you can change this to just solving, communicating one set of Lagrange multipliers. So usually you start with these to be zero, which means that they're just solving their own local optimization problems, ignoring everything else. Each vehicle computes its optimal solution. So a number of local problems are solved in parallel. And then in order to update the Lagrange multipliers, one can do that by basically solving this represents the gradient of the dual function. And one can update the Lagrange multipliers by doing a, basically a line search on that gradient. Now, generally this dual function is not, you can't solve for the gradient because of this infimum here. We use a subgradient method in the examples that we've used. So there are sort of technical properties, how you do that optimization. So this is actually. So if it's a non-convex problem, we don't have a, we can show that it may not converge to the solution. It converges to an epsilon optimal solution. If it's convex, it'll converge to the global optimal solution. So this is a subgradient. Question?
Another problem with this approach, and I don't know where I'm at really, is that you only guarantee to satisfy the constraints at once you converge to it, because you're relaxing the constraints and you only have a zero duality gap out of optimality. So if you want to run it in real time, you're going to run the problem that if you don't have all the time to converge, you don't really know whether your constraints are satisfied.
Right.
Correct.
So the point is that if it's not a convex problem, we're solving this dual problem, and in each iteration of the solution, we're getting closer and closer to an epsilon optimal solution. But unless we actually achieve the epsilon optimal solution, we're not guaranteed a feasibility. So that's true, and we have to live with that. So what we did was, okay, we did a number of experiments on large problems. We tested how long it took to do the computation or to get within a certain bound of a feasible solution, and then we basically relaxed the constraints, so we added a boundary onto what it meant to be feasible. And so unless you can solve the optimal problem, like in a convex problem, you're not guaranteed that you can get feasible. You're guaranteed that you'll approach feasible solution. You'll get within epsilon of a feasible solution.
Are the constraints tractable?
Are the constraints?
Constraints are helpful in solving the primary problem.
It's not necessarily clear which is easier to solve. Whether or not it's easier to solve the primal problem with constraints or this, we still have constraints on the dual problem. So we only dualize the coupled constraints. Usually the constraints on the dual problem are like dynamic constraints because they only involve the local variables anyway. And so that is problem by problem dependent.
Okay.
What are the size of the problems?
I'll show you some examples. So in this, you saw the simple formation example. I think that's better enunciated if I go to the airline problem and I'll talk about the sizes of the problems and the time to compute those solutions. But again, that's problem dependent.
Another question, sorry. So when you introduce this relaxed constraint, you sort of introduce some more agent into the system. That's not necessarily controlled in the same way as a real agent. So when you're trying to solve everything in a decentralized way, I don't know whether you should treat this two different kind of agent. I saw that you're adding in like virtual agent there. So whether this virtual agent share the same property of the real agent, or it's just like a shadow agent that has induced dynamics from the agent.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we treat them as they're like shadow agents. So we're just introducing, they're just slack variables in the problem. So mathematically, the variables are treated the same as the variables that they originated from.
But then if they're not controlled in the same way, because you have control on the real agent, you don't have control on the virtual agent.
I think the point you made is that these agents have an existence only in the process of the optimization problem. And they're not writing separately differential equations for them.
It's like a tool to help us solve the optimization problem, but when we get back to the original solution, we're only looking at the actual agents themselves. Sorry, I misunderstood your question. Alright, so let's just... So we have an algorithm for solving this. It has its benefits, it also has its drawbacks, as were pointed out. And so let me just show you a few simulations. The blue represents that original centralized solution that I showed, and the green represents the decentralized solution. So after 5 iterations of the problem, you get a decentralized solution which is not very close to the centralized solution. And that's because after 5 iterations, the algorithm hasn't converged yet. After 10 iterations of this problem, you see that the decentralized solution is getting closer to the centralized solution. So we could actually, you know, but it's still problem dependent. We could look at each problem and assess how long it takes to get close to a centralized solution. How to do that generally is interesting. You know, how to figure out what epsilon should be when we talk about an epsilon optimal solution. And that's something we're looking at, but it's hard, and I don't know how to do that yet. Complexity results. So I think the point here is that in terms of the computation, it can be much more efficient to solve the decentralized problem. The communication, so in the decentralized case, you're communicating these Lagrangian multipliers back and forth. In the centralized case, we're assuming that there's some centralized machine which is taking all information, solving the problem, and giving the solutions back to the individual agents. So, and this is just to show that, you know, the simulations I showed before were with kinematic models, because the method is, you know, it's a general method. It can treat nonlinear dynamics, of course, non-convex problems. So just to show a decentralized solution with nonlinear dynamics. And so this is a more, so applying that same technology, we have a field that we'd like to achieve some kind of uniform surveillance over. I'm not sure why it's jumping around like that. And then there's these sort of pop-up points of interest that happen. And at that time, we'd like a larger concentration of sensors around those pop-up points of interest. So we have a general field, and the trajectories of the aircraft are initially set to form a uniform surveillance over that field. And when a pop-up point of interest comes, the aircraft that are closest to that must form a particular formation around that pop-up point. And we run this, so we've taken that decentralized optimization scheme and we're running it in a receding horizon manner so that we can see these sort of pop-up constraints or treat them properly. Okay, so I'd like to now, in the last 10 minutes of the talk, I'd like to show how we took this idea of decentralized optimization and applied it to the airline problem. Are there any questions before we just launch this last bit?
Well, the decentralized optimization is at least, right? You're hoping to hover faster to the centralized, the result of centralized. So do you know how, is this hover speed sensitive to how many agents in the system?
That's a good point. So the larger the subproblems, the longer it takes to compute them. So it's not so much how many agents there are in the system, but how coupled they are that causes that really affects the speed of doing this. Once we decouple it, we distribute the process over a number of, we actually solve it in our lab. We have a multiprocessor machine, and we distribute the computation over each of those processors. So we solve the local optimization problems in parallel. So it's really, the time is the time of the slowest, the largest local optimization problem, and the communication time from to then communicate information back and forth. Yeah. Okay, so here we, just as an example problem, we form, so this is the example, similar to the example that I showed you before. So here I have 4 points in the network, and I've got this managed arrival reservoir that I was talking about earlier. This is just some motivation. So we're using this Eulerian model viewpoint to combat the complexity of Lagrangian air traffic models. And this is an interesting plot. This is actual data that we took from these airports flowing into Chicago. So we're just looking at aircraft which are originating from these 4 airports coming into Chicago. And you can see that in terms of looking at these as the distribution amongst the airlines, we have the yellow crosses represent United, the blue crosses represent American, and green represents all others. You see these like Air Canada coming in from Canada. But it's, and this is about 10 or more than that, about 15 different airlines. So we have a number of different airlines which have to share this network. And we can roughly break these up, or we can try to classify these airlines into large airlines with a lot of aircraft that are, you know, using up a lot of the resources, And smaller airlines, which are there, they're important, but they're using up a smaller number of resources. So our agents now represent these airlines which have different characteristics. This is the model that I presented briefly earlier, so just to introduce you to the variables again. The network is modeling, so the origin destination airports, we have en route nodes, so those are the nodes in the network. The links are unidirectional, though I can introduce two links if I want both directions. And the position along the link is my x variable. So I have a number of links, and then x represents the position along each link, subscripted appropriately for the link. The contested resources here are the density, so I have some maximum density that I need to satisfy. And the control variables are the inflow, the velocity profile, and the flow split parameter. This is the PDE that I showed you earlier. And it's nice because the problem complexity is fixed by the network architecture and time scale resolution, not by the number of aircraft. Each agent has a local utility function. So as I said earlier, this is like Naomi's question. The weights are chosen by the airline. So this alpha represents some sort of inherent cost to the airline. And then we, the local cost we represent as a quadratic deviation. So this is the flow through the system. The QI represents the flow, the product of density and velocity. And deviations from a desired schedule are penalized quadratically. This is a fairly good approximation because what typical data shows that 70% of the aircraft, 70% of air traffic delays are under 30 minutes. But 70% of the cost of delays are those delays that are over 30 minutes. So it's much more expensive to have longer delays because that incorporates, for airlines to have longer delays, because then you've got passengers which don't make their connections and the schedule goes off. So half an hour buffer is not that expensive. So we model that with a quadratic penalty. Now this is our choice for each airline. The form of the cost function is something that's difficult. And this is, you know, this is our first crack at this problem in which we, you know, came up with cost functions which made sense, but this is sort of work in progress, what these cost functions should actually be. One idea, and this is something that the air traffic, that the FAA tends to do now, is if there is, so we have a desired flow, and if there is some kind of capacity constraint like weather, they typically proportion the flow. They scale the flow proportionally to the original schedule. So you take the desired flow relative to the sum of all the desired flow, and that fraction is multiplied by the new maximum in flow that you're allowed, and that gives you the scheduled flow for each airline over each link. It's an okay rule. It's impartial. It's collusion-proof. You know, you can't get airlines colluding together to get a better flow because it's just scaled proportionally. But the idea was in studying these policies is, can we design a mechanism in which we could do better than this, in which aircraft can do better than just this proportionally scaled scheduled flow. So we did two things. We used the idea of decentralized optimization. And then in forming the overall optimization problem, we used a market-based approach. So we basically allowed airlines to enunciate their preferences using a currency which they all care about, which is dollars. Okay, so the airlines directly propose flow control strategies to avert excess demands. These are communicated to some central authority, which we assume is the FAA, and the FAA sets the prices. So there's an iterative scheme between local optimization, global setting of prices, that's communicated back to the airlines, local optimization, et cetera. Airlines can keep all information private except how much they're willing to pay for a certain resource, which is flow on a link at a certain time. And we assume an existing ideal schedule, actually that schedule-based flow that I showed on the previous view graph, and we assume the existing ideal schedule, which is what they originally wanted before it was penalized, and we penalize deviations from this schedule. Here again, there's a choice of ways in which we could aggregate those individual costs to form a global cost function. One is a Nash bargaining solution. The one that we use and the one that we used in the previous problem as well is called an aggregate cost solution, where we just sum up the individual local costs. There's some reasons we choose this over the Nash bargaining solution, which tends to sort of smooth out, make everything equal, because you know, you can see that individual weights for each airline aren't maintained in this product where they are in this sum. So you, in this aggregate cost, you can maintain that aircraft one values something 10 times more than aircraft two, for example. This is the overall primal problem. So we're minimizing the aggregate cost subject to the dynamics, which is a PDE constraints, and then restrictions on the velocity, flow split parameter, and the overall density. The coupling constraints are the is the density constraint. These constraints here don't couple the individual entities to each other. Okay, so in the interest of time, I can go through this quite quickly because it's the same method that I showed before. We use a dual decomposition method in which we formulate a dual in which we've got a number of local optimization problems and then a global optimization problem. This is the price, basically the FAA solves this central problem, determining what the basically the descent rate should be for the overall price update. So how is that solved? Let's just skip. We solve the, so we have local optimization problems, they're nonlinear functions, they've got PDE constraints. The method that we use to solve those is the adjoint method. So this is a particularly elegant method for solving optimization problems when you have PDE constraints. It's a fairly standard method. It's used a lot in aerodynamic shape design. And so Anthony Jameson at Stanford was one of the ones who sort of pushed us towards looking at this algorithm. And it's nice because it's a very sort of elegant way to take into account the PDE constraints. It's the details are quite interesting. We won't go through them. The resulting algorithm, again, it's a dual decomposition algorithm. So the schedule-based allocation is defined by proportionally scaling back the ideal flow. Dual decomposition is performed on the aggregate cost primal. So I have a local cost function and then a global cost function that the, or a centralized cost problem that the FAA solves. And so the iteration is as follows. The central computer, the FAA, communicates prices to agents. Agents solve the local optimization problems and they transmit density fields and control inputs. The FAA updates the dual variables. And if the densities exceed the maximum, it augments the prices, otherwise it decreases the prices. So let's conclude with a simulation. This is a fairly small simulation, but it's kind of large scale for us, which is I've got three airports, and I've got four airlines. I've got a big expensive airline, a big cheap airline. So big means the number of aircraft, sort of the demand that they have on this network, and that's modeled by the inflow. So big airlines have a larger demand for aircraft per minute. The smaller airlines have a smaller demand for aircraft per minute, and that's modeled as their inflow demand, what they want to put into the network. Expensive and cheap. So expensive is this modeled by this parameter alpha. That was the weighting that each aircraft had on their local cost function. And the expensive airlines have higher alpha than the cheap airlines. So we had 12 processes going on. There's three nodes with four aircraft. So we get 12 individual local optimizations that are going on. And we set this up in our lab on our multiprocessor machine. We have a central FAA pricing center. And the information, the prices, are transmitted over SSH to the individual computers. This is just showing how long it took us to do the computation. Of course, we compare the central computation we did in MATLAB and the decentralized computation we did in C, so it's not a fair comparison. But you can see some of the times there. I'll show you a couple of movies. This is the original ideal flow, what the aircraft actually wanted. And you can see over, and the colors represent the four different airlines. So yellow and blue in particular are the big airlines. And there comes a point at which the capacity is exceeded in these links here. So we set capacity constraints, and again, that's a constant problem in air traffic control. Those are always fluctuating due to basically weather in the system. Now, if you scale back, so you take that ideal flow and all you do is proportionally scale it back, which is sort of what air traffic control tends to do now, you see, you know, that basically you get a scaled back flow, a scaled back version of the ideal flow. But what's interesting now is to look at this market-based solution. And you can't really see it from the movies. I'll show you the plots afterwards. But the thing to notice here is that the shorter routes, so these are the longer routes, the shorter routes quickly become populated with the big airlines, the ones that have the most aircraft. And that's reflecting the local cost function. We have a quadratic penalty on the deviation from desired flow. So the more aircraft, the more flow, so the bigger airlines are in this mechanism, the blue and yellow, I guess it started over again, but you see that the shorter routes are typically populated by the larger airlines because they're the ones with the more expensive cost if you penalize them by making the big airlines fly over the longer routes and incurring a larger delay or a longer delay in their flight times. So here you can see that a little more graphically for each of the airlines. Blue represents the scaled back schedule. So you can see that the delays incurred for each airline are quite large with the original schedule. Green is the original ideal, and we notice that the market solution, which is the red solution, is much closer to the ideal than is the scaled back solution. So the airlines, the smaller airlines, whereas the larger airlines typically match quite well, the market matches the ideal quite well, you see a deviation in the smaller airlines due to the effect that I showed you on the previous movie. But what's actually happening there is that the smaller airlines, because this is set up as a market, the smaller airlines are basically getting paid to incur more delay. So they're getting more money by being paid from the money that's going to the FAA from the big airlines to incur those larger delays, because it's cheaper for them to incur the delays. So schedule cost. We can actually see that airline 4 does better in the market cost than it would have done in the ideal schedule where all of these numbers were zeros. And so these guys are getting, the smaller airlines are getting payment from the FAA, and that money is coming from the payment that the larger airlines are making to the FAA. Okay, so to conclude the talk, in summary, we're using decentralized optimization. It's a standard method called dual decomposition, and what we have been doing is studying how one would apply dual decomposition in these different contexts, namely how to introduce slack variables, what constraints to dualize. The computation load is distributed amongst the resources. This allows for flexibility and shared information. We've been working with this adjoint-based method for PDE constrained problems. That's another piece of technology that we showed. And then most of our recent research in this problem has been in designing market-based solutions for air traffic flow. Airlines propose flow control strategies, the FAA sets the prices, the airlines buy and sell the available resources to maximize their profits, and somehow it's more like we'd like to design this so that we get a rational solution. Okay, so future directions. Air traffic flow control, so we're going to expand to larger scenarios and study the formulation of the cost functions. So that's something that is, you know, this is, as I said, a first crack. We proposed a local cost function and the way we'd aggregate those to form a global. We'd like to work with airline operation centers, and actually we're working with a consulting company that's working with airline operation centers to try to understand better ways of formulating these costs. And we're working with this guy, Paul Milgram, I said, at Stanford, who's consulting also with the airline operation centers. So better ways to design the market mechanisms. Is this correct? How do we make this sort of a richer problem? And we're also, although this is sort of the problem I started with, also in the lab, we're continuing to work on applying these optimization techniques to multi-vehicle coordination. And so just at the end of the talk, I'll show you our current test bed. So I showed you our fixed-wing aircraft at the beginning of the talk. Right now we're spending more time building smaller vehicles that we can fly. We can just go outside and fly them. We don't have to fly them at NASA Ames. These are quad-rotor vehicles. We bought the initial frame And then we realized that we had to change it all and design our own processors and everything. So we now have our new STARMAC. So STARMAC stands for the acronym is the Stanford Testbed of Autonomous Rotorcraft for Multi-Agent Control. And so the idea is that we'll have a bunch of these. We now have two that we'll use as a testbed for implementation of these decentralized control methods, decentralized optimization methods. So all the computation, sensing, et cetera, is done on board. Thank you very much, and if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer.